Welcome to Continent of Media 0609. Continent of Media is made possible by Universal Radio. Visit their website, www.universal-radio.com, or phone them for a free catalog, 1-800-431-3939. Universal also sponsors www.dxing.com, where you'll find much more information, including access to this program in real audio. We concluded the previous edition with some information about two-way communications on HF in Alaska. Let's pick up on that same topic. 3230 was one of the main frequencies mentioned, and in the UDX forum, there are more reports of this. WKZ-44 in Bethel, Alaska was heard in mid-August on 3230, single sideband, with messages to several bush villages, according to someone in Alaska citing as RF probe. 3230 has seen some unusual activity. At 1600 UT, an individual contacted Bethel and requested extraction from Karlskog, and a heated argument occurred when informed the bush plane was canceled due to weather. There was talk about blood samples needing immediate testing for bird flu. There are, of course, many migratory birds nesting in the summer in Alaska. Fortunately, we haven't heard anything further about an actual outbreak of bird flu in Alaska. Brendan, WA7HL in Tucson, explained, "I don't think there's an outbreak yet. There was supposed to have been a comprehensive ongoing sampling program starting in June to look for the H5N1 virus. Blood samples would decay quickly, so timely analysis is critical. Keep listening. This could be quite interesting. I would be more concerned if they were not communicating anymore. That might mean the powers that be wanted to keep things quiet." Another Alaska bush frequency used by all kinds of stations is 5167.5 upper sideband. Government, civilians, even hams in an emergency, whoever has need of communications with emergency services. If a bird flu outbreak began in Alaska, we most likely could expect it to become very active. Given that it is used in the U.S. only in Alaska, it may be very hard to hear outside the state, but it's on HF and it may go further. So again, that's 5167.5 upper. Before leaving Alaska, a bit about a broadcast station. The IRCA list, Patrick Martin in Oregon says, "I phoned KICY in Nome and found out that they're running 25 kilowatts non-directional from one tower." This was on September 11th. Their nominal setup, previously, that is, they had 50 kilowatts day, 10 at night, with what is called a U10 combination of antenna patterns and powers. That burned up last year, and two of the three towers had to be taken down because of permafrost. They're using a 1959 tower in the same place as their original tower that fell back in the 60s when they were 5 kilowatts. Next June, they break ground for the new setup. The two towers are on the ground and will be reinstalled next summer once the ground melts enough to do the work. The new setup should be completed by September 1st of 07. When operational, it'll be U10 at 50 kilowatts day and night. The time they will be directional is from 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. local time, which is in the evening in Siberia. Prime time for listeners there, rest of the time 50 kilowatts non-directional. That broadcast to Siberia is in Russian. According to a website, www.kicy.org, Russian is scheduled from 11 p.m. until 4 a.m. Station is run by the Evangelical Covenant Church. Now, local time in summer is UT-8. Which is triple daylight time, because according to its longitude of 165 degrees west, they should be on UT-11. All of this could cause a bit of confusion about what time the directional Russian broadcast actually occurs and whether it changes 1 hour from winter to summer, as in Alaska, and whether that correlates with daylight time over in Russia. In any event, it seems they're still doing the Russian broadcast, even though they don't have the directional antenna going at that time. While they are non-directional, that means signals to the lower 49 should be more favorable. It's hard to think of any other U.S. medium wave station which has a SkyWave external service and a directional antenna to match, that is, when they're back in business. Quite a number of U.S. stations in the northern tier of states are directional northwards or into Canada at night, but that's more of a consequence of having to protect U.S. stations in other directions than a deliberate desire to serve sparsely inhabited Canadian rural areas. There is, of course, WTOR 770 in Youngstown, New York, which is aimed at Toronto, but only in the daytime and via groundwave. KICY 850 in Nome is admittedly broadcasting transoceanically. Across time zones, the dateline, in a different language, also traversing national and continental boundaries using the ionosphere. There is one station in a somewhat similar situation, but I think it's again a result of having to protect another U.S. station, KGBT 1530, in extreme South Texas, which seems to have more nighttime coverage in Mexico than the U.S. Now some Canadian news. On the WTFDA list, Doug Smith in Tennessee says there's guaranteed confusion on 103.1. If you hear California 103, don't be sure you're listening to California. Look at their website, www.california103.com, and you'll find it's based in Calgary, Alberta. However, when I looked at the site, I saw they were promoting an event in Inglewood, spelled with an I, which is, of course, a suburb of Los Angeles. Is there an Inglewood around Calgary, too, or do they think they have a huge audience in Los Angeles via webcast? Guess what? Ricky Leong in Calgary says there is a neighborhood there called Inglewood. The station on 103.1 is listed as CIQX in Calgary. According to the FM Atlas of last year, their slogan then, which apparently they've changed, was The Breeze. Since Canada already has a digital radio system on the L-band, which no one listens to, Canada's been slow to get into the IBOC or HD system, which is spreading like a cancer in the U.S. However, in mid-August, on the AM-FM TVDX list at QDH.net, Saul Chernos in Toronto says CBC 99.1 was heard testing IBOC with strong hash on 99.3 and 98.9. CBC has indicated it would be doing tests on 99.1. He also heard hash on adjacents to CJBC 90.3 and Aboriginal voices on 106.5. Barry McLarnon in Ottawa, IRCA, says yes, tests are taking place on 99.1 and 90.3, but probably not on 106.5. However, no AM IBOC tests are coming in the near future, meaning not on the medium wave band in Canada. Dean McIntyre in Alberta tells us more and more Canadian AM stations are applying to move to FM, most notably recently CBA 1070 in Moncton, New Brunswick. That's the major maritime station of CBC Radio 1. They've applied to move to FM 106.1. And that would leave the CBC with only six 50-kilowatt AM stations in the entire country. And, of course, leaving a gaping hole on 1070 in southeastern Canada and northeastern USA. Ricky Leong also forwards the notice with the usual request for permission to simulcast programming of the new FM station for a period of 3 months from the date of implementation of the new FM. I comment that this would be a major loss to the CBC Radio 1 listening audience in much of that part of the continent. CBA 1070 is the best or only place to hear CBC in many remote and non-Canadian locations, as well as for anyone preferring to use AM radio at home or in the car. By the way, CBA was originally located at Sackville, the same location as Radio Canada International's shortwave transmitter site. I was thinking it still was, although identifying with the larger city of Moncton, but Bill Westenhaver explains, CBA has not been at Sackville since the early 70s. It was built there in the late 30s and was joined at that site by RCI, but CBA 1070 moved at some point in the early 70s. perhaps when RCI was expanding its shortwave transmitters. So that explains why, although we hear many mixing products among the shortwave frequencies at Sackville, we do not hear mixing products 1.07 megahertz away. Here's a very strange story from Canadian Press via Mike Cooper. CBC Chairman Guy Fournier has resigned after controversial comments he made about bestiality and bowel movements. Fournier, who's five sesquidecades old, became the target of anger and criticism after falsely claiming in a French-language magazine article that Lebanon permits bestiality, and for granting a lengthy interview on the joys of bowel movements. More on this from the Globe and Mail via Harry Van Vogt. Mr. Fournier became the target of ridicule and an embarrassment for both the CBC and the government. Here's part of what he said in a 12-minute radio interview. What is more extraordinary is that as we get older, we can defecate once a day, whereas making love once a day may become a problem. Therefore, the pleasure is more durable and more frequent than with the other. The prolific scriptwriter and producer, whose films and TV series have been broadcast on private and public French-language TV for close to 50 years, could return to writing humor columns for a gossip magazine, even though he quit the job in a last-ditch effort to hold on to his CBC position. Quite a while before this, there was an editorial by Ossie Michelin for The Labradorian titled CBC Television Tuned Out. It was once the role of CBC TV to be the voice of Canadians, but after years of in-house fighting, budget cuts, and an expanding reliance on advertising, it's turned that voice into a whisper, drowned out by the yelling coming from down south. CBC Radio has done an excellent job over the years of keeping up with advancing technologies, representing local interests, and offering entertaining Canadian culture at home and abroad. Its airwaves are on par with the best of public radio around the world. CBC Television, however, has not been so fortunate. In fighting with the more sophisticated mediums, the radio cannot carry the burden of our shared identity alone. CBC Radio is not perfect, but it is definitely on the right track. The potential for CBC Television is great. It just has a lot further to go than its radio counterpart. The talent pool in Canada is huge. We have more comedians and rock bands than we know what to do with. Many American programs are even filmed in Canada because it's cheaper and we have top-quality production companies. The most important thing the network needs to do is eliminate advertising, which cannot be done until the federal government agrees to fill the gap of advertising revenue. The CBC is the only public broadcaster on Earth that relies on public funds and advertising income. CBC Television has abandoned its regional focus, unlike radio, which has a strong sense of regional programming. TV cut Labrador News in the late 80s, along with dozens of other local news programs across the country. Consistency is another obstacle facing CBC Television. Program lineups are constantly shifting. Viewers don't know what they are going to get when they turn on the TV. The Monday Report with Rick Mercer was moved to Tuesday and renamed the Mercer Report. The Street Sense time slot has been passed around for years, and the Halifax-based This Hour has 22 minutes as well. They even moved the syndicated 5 o'clock staple, The Simpsons, to 4:30, replacing it with Fraser. And now the CBC is bumping their flagship news show, The National, from 10 to 11 o'clock to make room for an American reality TV program. Canada needs CBC Television. We need it to share our common experiences with each other. We need it to show the world what Canada in the 21st century is like. We need to be heard. This is Continental Media, 0609, our address, P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK 73702, USA, or WORADIO at yahoo.com. You can read much more about the stories we mention in DX Listening Digest via worldofradio.org. On the IRCA list, Cal Arman, also known as John Calorman, curmudgeon, writes on birdwatching and DXing. There's a correlation between them, believe it or not. Both hobbyists keep lists that require date, time, and place, and are subject to verification by others. I dabbled in birding for a while, took a lot of telephoto shots of backyard birds, got involved with Southern Illinois Audubon Societies, and even started a master list, but did not keep it up after the first week or so because of hobby overload. CIDX publisher Sheldon Harvey is also a bird watcher and is active in the Quebec Audubon Society. But do the birds have some kind of slop-mongering garbage that promises to be the next best thing? CD quality bird songs being pushed by certain suits in the avian industry, but going over like the proverbial atomic number 82 balloon with the general public, says Mike Brooker in Toronto, adding, God keep our land glorious and Eibach free. Keller Mann replies, my favorite bird songs are the mockingbird and the catbird, who are likely to come up with anything, while others sing the same songs over and over again, sort of like today's cookie-cutter radio chains. Well, this prompted Sheldon Harvey himself to reply in DX Listening Digest. At the 2006 Winter SWL Festival, I actually presented an informal evening workshop discussing some of the similarities between birding and DXing. There are quite a few. I was surprised by the turnout and the reaction from participants. A fun experience. There are a number of DXers, several at Winterfest, who are also birders. Former Winterfest organizer Bob Brown is an avid birder, organizing some of the annual birding events at Cape May, New Jersey, during the annual migration period. Certainly birds do not QSL, but using your ears to identify songs isn't a whole lot different than identifying radio stations by their interval signals. One major difference between the rare DX catch and the rare bird sighting is that in the case of a radio station, it usually hangs out at the same place at the same time, frequency. It's just a matter of being on frequency and hoping the propagation brings you the signal. In the case of the rare bird, it may be hanging out at a particular place for a period of time, but there's one major difference, wings, making the task that much more challenging. Both activities present great challenges and offer great rewards. Unfortunately, some of the endangered species are becoming as rare as those hundreds of tropical band radio stations we used to be able to track down. Sheldon refers us to the website, www.birdprotectionquebec.org. Speaking of wings, here's something about names of air navigation routes, sent on to us by Will Martin. It originated in STL Today in St. Louis, the Post-Dispatch. Clever names mark routes pilots take overhead, published September 11th, written by Eliza Crouch. Unless you moved to St. Louis yesterday, you know Lindbergh, Manchester, Olive, and Kings Highway. What about Cards, Ozark, Lindy, and Gatwick? These are routes that thousands of St. Louisans travel daily, but not by car, by airplane. The sky above Lambert Field is filled with routes and intersections, all given five-letter codes by air traffic controllers. The intersections are called fixed positions, and they represent specific locations of latitude and longitude. They serve the same purpose as exits on an interstate. The names often come with a sense of humor. In the 1980s, flight officials in Kansas City named a fixed position over St. Louis Coors. Denver controllers wanted the name a few years ago. Controllers in St. Louis gave it to them and renamed their position AUGST for August Bush. Steve Clark, an air traffic controller in Weldon Springs, said we felt something along the lines of Anheuser-Busch would be more appropriate to the St. Louis area. There are points above St. Louis called, I'm going to spell these out, DIRTT, FARMR, LORLE, and HARDI. Others were inspired by sports. There is a departure route called Blues. There are fixed positions called STAN, STAAN, and MUZUL, MUZUL. There's a series of positions named for the game of pool. One arrival path goes from SCRCH to BREAK to FATSS to QBALL. Names at other airports are just as memorable. Approach Newark International from the northeast, and you'll either cross Howya or Doin, H-O-W-Y-A or D-O-O-I-N. And who can forget H-O-L-D-M in Las Vegas? Neither Will nor I had ever heard of these strange air navigation names and wonder if there is a comprehensive alphabetical key to them. Now to the matter of shortwave frequency coordination. continuing problem is that many Latin American stations still operating on shortwave are not involved in worldwide frequency coordination. In the September NASB newsletter, Jeff White writes, after having come back from the HFCC conference in Athens, "One of the major reasons Latin American stations don't participate is that the meetings are usually held in the Eastern Hemisphere, I might add, and also in the Northern Hemisphere, and are therefore very expensive for them to attend. Spaniards suggested a regional coordination meeting once a year in Latin America could be more affordable for many stations, and it might be possible to get assistance from the ITU for the organization of such regional meetings, consistent with the ITU's desire to foster regional coordination in developing countries. Such regional meetings would also be of great benefit to shortwave stations in North America, as we are the ones most likely to be victims of interference from uncoordinated broadcasts from other parts of this hemisphere." The delegates from HCJB in Ecuador and Christian Vision in Chile expressed their strong interest in the idea of a regional coordination meeting, and HCJB offered to consider hosting the first such meeting in Quito, perhaps in June of next year. "My comment is that would be fine, however, the HFCC people seem to be hung up on the idea that they actually have to get together in person to work out frequency coordination in this day of instant communication via internet and other means. Furthermore, they seem to be unwilling to consult DX or even consumer publications such as Passport or the WRTH to find out what stations are really on what frequencies, even if they aren't HFCC members. And there's another matter of concern to frequency planners, which I fear was overlooked at the August meeting in Athens. The fact that starting in 2007, the U.S. and probably Canada will be starting daylight shifting time earlier than before on the second Sunday in March rather than the first Sunday in April. There had been a week of confusion between the last Sunday in March when Europe goes on DST and the first Sunday in April. But now there will be a fortnight of confusion in 2007 from March 11th to 25th when North America has already shifted time and Europe has not. Now, in the last few years, the A season has begun on the last Sunday in March, with North America lagging a week later. But now, will the A season start earlier, or will it be just a shift in the B season frequencies for those 2 weeks? Well, in the case of WYFR, we hear they'll just keep going as before, but they're one of the few North American stations which does not usually make a DST one-hour shift anyway in programming. So it's still unknown how the others will cope with this, but there could be some collisions if North American stations make one-hour shifts on the same frequencies while the rest of the world does not. It could be even worse, because sometimes there will be 3 weeks of a gap that is a sesquifortnight of confusion. In fact, that will happen in 2008 from March 9th to 30th, since there will be 5 Sundays in March. This, of course, is assuming that the previous dates remain for the time changes. Furthermore, there will then be, starting next year, a week of confusion in the other direction in the fall, as the USA goes off DST 1 week later than Europe, rather than on the same date. It will then be the first Sunday in November. I've also mentioned the following in Monitoring Times, but in case you haven't seen it, there will be a DX meeting in Peru in February. They're calling it the first Peruvian DX meeting. It'll be in the city of Tarma in Junin on February 20th to 22nd, the weekend Friday through Sunday. There'll be connections to Lima, where I suppose many of the attendees will be coming from. But this would be a chance for those from outside Peru to combine a holiday there with a DX convention. Among those organizing it are some Peruvian DXer names you may recognize: Carlos Gamarra, Alfredo Cañote, and Cesar Perez. Motto is DXing is not a competition, but to share experiences. Well, here's email address for further information if you're seriously interested in attending, and I assume it will be mostly in Spanish. CPDS figure 1 at hotmail.com. That's Cesar Perez Dioses. I'll give it phonetically. Charlie Papa Delta Sierra 1 at hotmail.com. We got this notice via Pablo Alfredo Albornoz Rojas, via Dario Monferrini, and possibly they would be surprised to hear from people outside South America, but you can see about making arrangements. On at least two occasions in late September, public television in Oklahoma made last-minute changes in its schedule. Two PBS programs with some sexual content were delayed at the last minute until later in the evening. One of them was about Andy Warhol, which had been scheduled at 8 p.m. but suddenly shifted to 9 p.m., and another about Marie Antoinette. That was scheduled at 8 p.m., but it was bumped altogether until midnight, when it had already been scheduled to replay. I told OETA, I'm getting pretty fed up with your last-minute rescheduling of PBS primetime programs. It's painfully obvious that you don't have the guts to broadcast programming for adults at the same time as any other PBS station. I got this terse reply from Carolyn Hassan of OETA. The program did air after midnight due to new FCC regulations governing public television. A decision was made by council not to air the program during prime time because of inappropriate content and risk losing our license to operate or be fined. We are sorry for any inconvenience, but hope you understand these scheduling changes. Well, I can understand their concern, but the situation is lunacy. National programming should be safe to carry across the board or not. I later found out this also happened in other cities. The Denver Post had a story by Dick Kreck saying that Channel 6 there bumped the program altogether, Marie Antoinette, but they were making some vague promises about rescheduling it later. Taking its place was another show titled The Naked Planet. Will Martin in St. Louis tells me that his public TV station bumped Marie Antoinette 1 hour later, filling that hour about sending women to Australia as prisoners. That program was filled with references to prostitution, sodomy, and bestiality. Then he saw the Marie Antoinette program, which had pixelated, censored images, not of actual photographs or video of nudity, but of artwork. So fuzzed up, I had no idea what was being censored, he says. Something disparaging to Marie being put out by the revolutionaries, but censorship caused the whole point to be lost. So thanks to inconsistent and unpredictable FCC enforcement about indecency, our freedom of speech is further eroded. That concludes Continental Media 0609, also known as World of Radio Extra 73. I'm Glenn Hauser.